Welcome to the Los Gallos Institute's current federal tax developments for the week of July 3rd, 2017. I'm Ed Zollers, and I'll be talking to you this week about some of the things that have happened this week in the area of federal taxes. We're going to be looking at a few things this week. We're going to start out with the question of, you know, the Senate's non-vote on a health care bill this week. So we'll have a little bit of discussion about where that appears to be going because of the various tax items that are inherent in that bill. We'll also talk about then a case where the taxpayer was discovered not to owe tax on funds that were wired from his IRA to buy stock that the custodian would not accept back. A Third Circuit has come in line to agree that mortgages must be subordinated before you make a conservation easement donation or you're not getting a tax deduction. We have an interesting case, a published tax court case this week, that expands when an employer can get a full deduction for paying for meals for an employee. This involved a hockey team and road games and meals paid for that. And finally, we're going to take a look at the fact the IRS this week finalized the regulations on the streamline application for 501c3 status. Well, it's summer, and many of you are probably listening to this after getting back from your 4th of July vacation, whatever you were up to doing this week. But we've got some courses coming up here late in July, so if you want to sign up and do some things, we've got a couple places to go. Rebecca Lee will be giving some A&A courses in Indianapolis coming up July the 24th. There'll be a one-day course on audits of defined contribution pension plans, emphasizing 401k plans. And on the 25th and 26th, there'll be an A&A staff level one training for entry-level staff. So those of you in the Indianapolis area that have new staff that need to get up to speed on A&A issues, I might consider that two-day course coming up in Indianapolis in July. For those of you more on the tax bent, I'm going to be doing courses in Bozeman, Montana, coming up on the 27th and 28th of this month. And the first course there will be Income Taxation of Trusts and Estates, Planning and Compliance. In that course, we'll be talking about lots of things that deal with the whole fun of a 1041. We're going to also discuss the idea of how the Montana Uniform Principal and Income Act impacts the computation of what is called accounting income on the 1041 and why that matters. And we'll talk about how that gets involved in all of this, because most of us have not had a whole lot of training about proper accounting treatment for items in a trust or estate. So we'll talk about where that goes. On the 28th, I'm scheduled to do a day on depreciation, repairs, and fixed assets tax considerations. That particular course will look at what's really changed significantly from 2014. We had the regulations that changed how we capitalize things, but also the PATH Act added a bunch of whole new changes to depreciation, especially in the area of real estate. Things became permanent. So we're going to talk about how the world's different now. We look at depreciation, repairs, and fixed assets. You can register for these courses. If you want to get Rebecca's courses, you go to www.inscpa.org. If you want to register for my courses in Montana, in Bozeman, you go to www.mscpa.org. You can sign up at either of those locations for the courses. And if you want to, you can also check your state society catalogs. We are presenting courses all over the country in various locations, so you can go ahead and check and see what's coming up in your society's catalog. Well, let's get to what's actually happening this week. And, of course, lots of press coverage this week on the health care bill. And from my perspective, you know, we're talking about here on this program, we're talking primarily about the tax impact of this bill. And fundamentally what happened this week was a bill was brought forward. The majority leader had a bill. He was planning, as originally announced, to bring it to the floor and have a vote by the time that we were having this podcast, a vote would have been held on the bill. As most of you are aware, that's not exactly what happened. The bill, in fact, couldn't even get the votes to go to a vote, it appeared, so it wasn't even attempted to take it to a vote. Currently, there are negotiations. There are a number of senators who have indicated issues with the bill. So at this point, it's again back to the case of can they cobble together the 50 votes they need? Because again, with the vice president being the tie-breaking vote, that would be 51 votes. That would get it through. But they definitely need 50 votes to make it happen, meaning they can only lose two Republican senators. We are, again, still continuing to assume, because it appears to be a very safe assumption, that there'll be no Democratic votes in favor of this particular bill. We'll just have to take a look, see what happens. Reportedly, a number of options have been given to the Congressional Budget Office to develop scores. One thing that may be concerning to many of you One of the big tax issues that was going to be in this bill would have been the repeal of the net investment income tax. There has been continuing discussion that that tax could be retained in order to provide for some money to allow certain other concerns to be addressed. It seems like that may create more issues on getting 52 votes because certain senators will pull away from the bill if that's not in there. The only thing you really do at this point is keep your eye on what's happening. This could be much like the House bill where we actually got a bill at, you know, after it appeared we weren't going to get a bill. And suddenly, you know, we had a vote 6 weeks after it appeared we'd abandon attempts to get a health bill. So keep your eye on that. Then also keep an eye on what happens after that bill's passed. And we have to take a look and then see what happens trying to reconcile this back with the House bill. But in any event, the Better Care Reconciliation Act, which is the Senate's name for the bill, did not come to a vote this week. The Senate will be out of session for the following week. So a week from now, we might know more only because there's been discussions, but we should not have a vote until the following week at the earliest. So keep your eye on what's happening there. Obviously, if it passes, we'll take a look at the tax provisions that actually make the final bill that's signed into law. Let's go ahead then and move on now to our first case for the week. This case is a case of McGaw versus Commissioner, case number 13665-14. It was appealed by the IRS to the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals, and they issued their opinion on the 26th of June. This was an interesting case because Mr. McGaw basically had an IRA with Merrill Lynch, and this IRA was currently holding 10,000 shares of FPFC stock. Now, for whatever reason, when Mr. McGaw wanted to buy additional shares, he was related to the company. Merrill Lynch refused to process the order, even though they already held the shares. Well, because of this, he wanted more shares for his IRA. He had Merrill Lynch wire the payment directly to the company. The company issued the shares in the name of the IRA, but when the shares came back to Merrill Lynch refused to hold them as custodian. Now, we get to a long back and forth about whether Merrill trying to return these shares to the gentleman and a couple of other issues. And at the moment, it doesn't appear that we know for sure where the shares are right now. So we have 7,500 shares floating out there somewhere of FPFC stock that nobody seems to know where they are. So the question becomes, you know, was this essentially a distribution from the IRA account? Now, a couple of facts. The year in question here is 2011, so we've got to watch a little carefully about how this case gets decided. It was pretty clear that the actual stock, you know, the wire went out in 2011, but the actual stock was not delivered or attempted to be delivered by being sent to Merrill Lynch until 2012. Merrill Lynch did issue a 1099-R on this distribution, and of course, not surprisingly, the IRS came after him looking for that as a distribution. Obviously, he responded that no, he was buying the stock. After the service looked at it, they still said, look, we believe he had constructive receipt of the funds, either actual or constructive. They said primarily constructive receipts because he directed payment from his IRA to a third party. And generally, the IRS then cited some case law that if you do that, if I ask my IRA, let's say I have an IRA with Vanguard, and if I have Vanguard send a check for $5,000 to put a down payment on, let's say, a new car to a dealership here in Phoenix, that's going to be considered a distribution. That'd be constructive receipts. The IRS said, well, this is just like that. He had money wired out of his IRA account that went to this third party. But the tax court didn't agree, and neither did the Seventh Circuit. Both cases, they came to the conclusion that, in fact, there was no constructive receipt in 2011. He was attempting to buy shares for the IRA. Now, it does raise an interesting question as to whether there's a problem for 12 or not, but 12 is not in front of us. They also found that the mere fact that, you know, Merrill Lynch had refused to buy it, and it turned out in the end Merrill Lynch wouldn't hold it, that did not cause the court to change its view in this point. In essence, he is looking to have these shares go into an IRA account. And of course, we don't know where it is right now. But the Seventh Circuit and the tax court basically assumed everything went against him. You know, they assumed that, in fact, he has the shares now. They assumed that, in fact, you know, he wired and he was aware Merrill Lynch would not take the shares back. Despite all of that, they held that this was still not anything because the shares weren't his. the shares were in the name of the IRA. His intention was to do the IRA. So interestingly enough, the Seventh Circuit, agreeing with the tax court, found that there was neither actual nor constructive receipt of the shares by the taxpayer. Next up, the Eighth Circuit threw in with two of its sister circuits on an issue. This is the case of RP Golf LLC versus Commissioner, case number 16-3277, Eighth Circuit case, and came in from June 26. Again, the Eighth Circuit, this is an appeal by the taxpayer of a loss in the tax court. The taxpayer in this case had donated property and had donated a conservation easement on property that the entity held. The property in this case was subject to a mortgage. And prior to actually making the transfer, they did not get a subordination of the mortgage. Now, that's somewhat important because the donation of a conservation easement, it's one of the few cases where you can get a donation deduction for donating a partial interest in property. But the key rule in this case is that you have to give a totally unrestricted conservation easement, you know, no strings attached, no issues on it. It's got to be basically protected in perpetuity. The IRS in regulations have indicated that, of course, if there's a mortgage, it's not protected in perpetuity, because if RP Golf LLC fails to make the mortgage payment and it is taken back by the lender, since that conservation easement wasn't there when they issued the loan, that you're not protecting it. So the regulations ask that you effectively must get subordination. And the Ninth Circuit and Tenth Circuit have both, the Ninth Circuit in the Minnick case, the Tenth Circuit in the Mitchell case, both that came out in 2015, took the position that you must subordinate the note before you make the contribution. In this case, they didn't get it subordinated, but they did get subordination done after the contribution was made. The IRS said, sorry, guys, that's too late. The taxpayer said, wait. No, this really isn't right. There was no real risk, no actual risk to the easement. And there, they tried to argue under Regulation 1.170-14G3 that the event was so remote as to be negligible, and that's not considered to be risking a in perpetuity transfer of your conservation easement. The IRS and the Eighth Circuit disagreed. And the Eighth Circuit accepted the Tenth Circuit's view in the Mitchell case and the Ninth Circuit's view in Minnick. You have to get rid of that. You have to basically get rid of that limitation, that mortgage. You've got to get a subordination prior to the contribution. If when the contribution is made, it is subject to a mortgage, the contribution is invalid. And you can't fix that problem by getting your subordination agreement after the donation has been made. Sorry, no deduction whatsoever is allowed. So now we have three separate courts of appeal, all of which now have agreed that you have to subordinate first. It's very difficult to pull off. I shouldn't say difficult. There are complicated issues with conservation easements. It is really something, if you haven't done a bunch of them, you don't really want to be the person in charge of running one through. They need to be very, very careful about how they're structured. It's important to have excellent legal and accounting work with you, accounting professionals working with you when you do that. And it's really important that every I be dotted, every T be crossed. Minor problems blow the deduction entirely. That's simply a fact of life. So be very careful. And again, this is three circuits agree. The subordination issue has to be properly taken care of if you're going to get a donation for a conservation easement. Next up, we have the case of Jacobs versus Commissioner, 148 TC number 24. This case came down on June the 26th of 2017, and it deals with the Boston Bruins hockey team. And the question here becomes about the Bruins' ability to deduct 100% of the cost of meals they paid for the team when the team was on the road. Now, generally, payments for meals are considered to be entertainment-style expenses, and under Section 274, a deduction is limited to 50% of the amount paid. But there is an exception at 274N2B. An employer can get 100% deduction for meals provided to employees if it is in the case of an expense for food or beverages. Such expense is excludable from the gross income of the recipient under 132 by reason of subsection C, that is, the de minimis fringe benefit rule. Under 132C, the de minimis fringe the de minimis fringe benefit rule essentially means that for this purpose, for the meals, it has to be an eating facility, right? The operating employer of an eating facility for employees shall be treated as a de minimis fringe if such facility is located on or near the business premises of the employer and revenue derived from such facility normally equals or exceeds the direct operating cost of such facility. Now, interesting aside, what we're talking about here is the Boston Bruins, like any professional hockey team, or any professional sports franchise for the most part, obviously plays half of their games on the road. And since there's not a second team in Boston, generally they're going to have hotel space travel there, and they get hotel space. That hotel, what they do for a hockey team, you bring your team in. Now, these players have very specific requirements for meals. You know, they have a standard set of, they have standard meals, standard issues they're going to do. They have training requirements. So the team will basically do a deal with the hotel not only to get rooms for the players, but also to get space in the hotel where they will set up a buffet for meals and where they're going to have training areas available. And as you might guess, they will not generally make this known to the general public because they don't really want the general public waltzing into those areas. So the question becomes, when the Boston Bruins pay for the meals of the team on the road, do they get 100% deduction? Now, there's no question the players don't have to include the value of those income of those meals in their income, because essentially there are two different sections. You can exclude it under 132, or you also could exclude a meal for the benefit of the employer under section 119A2. The issue becomes, however, if 119A2 is the only reason you're able to exclude, then the employer gets a 50% haircut. The IRS had interpreted this very strictly in Chief Counsel Advice 2011-51020. That case involved an airline. The airline was, you know, crews had to stay on the planes while it was at the gate because they needed to keep, you know, them on there. So the crews were on the planes, had to be on the planes. They would have meals delivered to the crew on the plane. The crew would eat the meals on the plane while the, you know, while the plane was at the gate. And the airline attempted to get 100% deduction. The IRS took the position that the airline did not, that the airline failed there because that was not an eating facility and they didn't actually prepare the food. Well, now we've got a similar problem here. The IRS position is saying, look, that hotel is not an eating facility for a couple of reasons. You know, it really isn't located on or near business premises of the employer. And essentially, and basically, you know, it's not really an eating facility under the regulations. So we believe that the Bruins, we fully understand that this is for the convenience of the employer, but it's, you know, it's not an eating facility. Now, the tax court, I should say, the tax court and the tax court came with a different idea. The tax court took a look at a number of factors that had to be met. Okay. First thing is, under the regulations, you can lease your eating facility. Now, the tax court said, well, we realize that technically we don't have something called a lease here, but we're renting space. They're saying, so from a practical standpoint, this is a lease. And because of that, so we're leasing an area where we're serving food and we're having that food prepared under that lease. So saying, okay, we're leasing a facility. Well, then we go on to another one. Is it operated by the employer? Again, they came to the conclusion that the contracts with the hotels meant it was being operated by the employer. They look at regulation 1.132-783. That provides if an employer contracts with another to operate an eating facility for its employees, facility is considered to be operated by the employer for purposes of this section. If an eating facility is operated by more than one employer, it's considered to be operated by each employer. The tax court used that regulation to say by contracting with the hotel, Effectively, this became a feeding facility operated by the Boston Bruins. So that's going to qualify them for this, okay? Now, the next one seems more interesting. The feeding facility must be at or near the employer's business premises. Well, if the Bruins are coming out here to the Valley, to Phoenix area, to play a game out in Glendale at the Coyotes Arena, that's pretty far away from, you know, any of the Bruins' own business operations back in Boston. And the IRS said, well, you know, obviously it's not there. You know, and secondly, the actual game out here is not going to be at the hotel they rent, hotel space they may have in the Valley. It's going to be at the rink, you know, at the arena. So really, this is not a business premises. The tax court disagreed. It found that significant activities that were related to the hockey games took place at the hotels. They said, look, they need to have training. They need to be have, and they need to have these specialized meals. You know, they do lots of things. They have specialized needs. You know, the players need things that are a little different. They don't want to have them just all out at McDonald's eating. So they said all of these relate to preparing the team for the game that will take place on the rink. And they noted, you know, half, and the nature of this business is half of the games are going to be on the road. So they found that these remote hotels were considered to be facilities of the team. They were on the business premises. Those hotels become business premises. You know, that should be very much, you know, on that. It was on the premises of the employer. So they found that that was just fine. That was not a problem. And they said there's no question because the final requirement is it must be provided during, immediately before, or after the employer's workday. And the IRS had conceded that that one would be met. So effectively, they said, and it didn't matter that we spent more time in Boston than we did like at a game at facilities in Phoenix or in Minneapolis, you know, or in Winnipeg or wherever we may be. That's not relevant. All of those still are our business locations and qualify. Now, one thing that's not clear is how far this goes. You know, will this really apply to us if we're trying to apply this situation, let's say, to a CPA firm that has auditors who are going out, you know, and may regularly have to do audits in remote locations. For instance, here in Arizona, you might have audit assignments where you may be operating out of an office in Phoenix, but let's say, you know, you have some audits that are in remote locations in far northeastern Arizona. Well, you know, those will be fairly remote, so you may have to have facilities there. We may have to have the hotel there. We may need to provide meals there. You know, all those things are required by the nature of what we're doing. Will that come under this overall structure? That's not totally clear. And obviously, we got to expect the IRS will want to narrowly confine this if they can. They're going to try to figure out why a basketball team won't get this and only hockey teams get it, and maybe why only Boston hockey teams get it. So I wouldn't be surprised to see it constrained. So don't be surprised if we see some more developments down this line and some more cases trying to figure out how far afield this goes. But it does open up a question if there is travel required. You know, if things have to be done on the road and there are certain things that take place at the remote facility, well, what point does it convert to a business premises? Obviously, as the Bruins case tells us, or I should say the Jacobs case, because that's one of the owners that's a partnership, and this was the one taken forward. It tells us basically that the tax, you know, that we do have a situation eventually where it becomes a business premises, and we can therefore get the deduction of the eating facility rules. We just don't know how far that goes. Final thing this week, we want to point out that the IRS issued final regulations with the streamlined application for 501c3 status. You may have been aware back in 2014, Form 1023-EZ streamlined process for applying for 501c3 status was brought out by the IRS. Now, in this case, the IRS doesn't so much rule on much of what you do. They just simply accept it. And then, for better or worse, on exam, they'll finally figure out if you really should have been a 501c3. Yeah, that's some people aren't so thrilled with that, but that's what it's there. Temporary and proposed regulations were issued back in 2014. Now, if you're going to do this simplified filing, it is done online. You have to go to www.pay.gov to do it. And you have to fill in what's essentially online a form. There is a PDF version of this form that the IRS makes available online at the website. But that form tells you immediately that this is just for information only. You have to do this electronically. Now, most organizations that qualify to use this generally are organizations looking for 501c3 that have projected annual gross receipts of $50,000 or less in the current taxable year in the next 2 years, that had annual gross receipts of $50,000 or less in each of the past 3 years, and the organization has total assets, fair market value of which do not exceed $250,000. And we can have a good faith estimate of those values. If all of those are true, generally you can apply for this. There are some exceptions. You'll see, find these current exceptions in Revenue Proc 2017-5, section 6.052. We have that list of those specialized categories that don't qualify for this quick filing. They're listed there, but if you elect to use it again, you go to pay.gov. The final regulations really didn't change anything that were in the proposed regulations. So it's not going to change anything we've done. We just now know that this is permanent, at least as permanent as final regulations become. And key thing to remember is you're going to have to make your applications online. That's still part of this. It's still there. Now, in our materials for this week, we do have a copy of the forms that you would be filing in. So if you're going to do that, and that really form is there to help you know this is the information you're going to need with, or a client's going to need to get online to fill this out and make it work. You'll find out that it consists of actually what's two pages really of information for most people. The third page is the signature page. And then if you had reinstatement after automatic revocation issues. So for most new entities, the first two pages are obviously key. We'll assume you know how to sign your name. So that's not going to be a problem. Okay. Well, happy 4th of July. Hopefully you guys, the few of you who are listening to this ahead of time before the 4th, hopefully you have plans and fun plans coming up for the 4th here. We're just trying not to melt in Phoenix. The rest of you hopefully had a good time in the 4th of July. You're back. You're ready to roll. And we'll take a look. We'll see what's up. Remember, Congress is out of town for the week, so we're not going to find out much of anything. I shouldn't say we still might find out something new, but we're not going to see anything passed this week unless they all decide to cut their vacation short. And I don't think congressmen like to cut vacations short, so we're not going to assume that's going to happen. This has been the current federal tax developments here for the week of July 3rd, 2017. Be sure to catch our updates online or our website at currentfederaltaxdevelopments.com. As things happen during the week, we'll start posting things there. Expect this to be a relatively slow week. We have a Tuesday holiday, so I don't expect a whole lot to happen on Monday. Obviously, nothing's going to happen on Tuesday. We're going to get to Wednesday, and people are partway through the week. So probably won't be a really big development week, but we'll check and see what goes on. You can send any questions or comments you have to me, edzollers@currentfederaltaxdevelopments.com. Send me any issues you want me to discuss or issues you would like to see discussed here. We'll take them at that address. You can also follow me on Twitter. My address there at edzollers. As I release new items, we'll post them up there, and you can read what we have to say. Hopefully everybody here now, it's summer, and here, especially if you're here in Phoenix, hopefully you're staying cool. And we'll look forward to seeing what comes up. We're into July. We'll see what happens here and talk to you about the tax developments next week as we come back for another week of current federal tax developments.